The Guardian. Science Weekly is brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace's award-winning templates are the most beautiful way to present your ideas online. See for yourself. Head to squarespace.com and enter the offer code GUARDIANSCIENCE to get 10% off your first purchase of a website or a domain. Squarespace. Make your next move. Make your next website.
There is something really new that is happening right now in machine learning and AI, which I think is new and important.
On Monday the 20th of April, a crowd gathered here at King's Place in London to hear a discussion on the future of artificial intelligence, or AI, as part of our Brainwave series supported by SEAT.
The fact is that natural intelligence is, by definition, embodied. There's no such thing as disembodied natural intelligence.
And train them over these vast training networks has made a big difference. But they clearly don't do things the same way that brains do.
Joining me on stage was Anil Seth, Professor of Cognitive Science and Computational Neuroscience from the University of Sussex, Maya Pantic, Professor of Affective and Behavioural Computing at Imperial College London, Anders Sandberg, Senior Research Fellow at Oxford University's Future of Humanity Institute, and Alan Winfield, Professor of Robot Ethics at the University of the West of England in Bristol.
It's hard to come out here than it looks, actually. I got lost on the way through.
I'm Ian Sample. This is Science Weekly.
So we've all encountered AI in science fiction, but artificial intelligence is ever more in the news. So what has happened to make AI important again? And how will it change our world?
To start with, I asked Anders what he does for his day job.
I'm a lapsed computational neuroscientist. That is, I got my PhD making neural network models of how the brain might work. But then I got interested in questions about how to improve the brain or what could happen if we connected stuff to the brain. So I got into ethics. So these days, technically, I'm a philosopher. Although that just means that I have a remit to both go from the very technical questions and try to solve some neural network issues over to thinking of literally fate of humanity. And trying to bridge the spectrum, what does this technology mean for us? And what can we do meaningfully that actually will help us have a better future?
And then the same question to Maya and Alan.
I do computer vision and machine learning, which means I analyze images and videos and try to learn certain patterns from those. I specialize in human behavior understanding. So we try to analyze human facial expressions and human vocal expressions and then analyze, for example, emotion from that, like, for example, that you're attentive now, or that you're bored, or that you doubt what I'm saying, this kind of stuff, as well as application of those in various contexts. So very interesting context for me is the medical context, and we are currently working on analysis of facial expressions for autistic kids with robots, and on automatic analysis of depression and dementia, and then early diagnosis of these based actually on behavioral signals.
I'm an old-fashioned, actually old, electronics engineer. I spent the first part of my career working on safety-critical systems in industry. But as a robot ethicist, I'm a kind of professional worrier. You know, that my job is to worry about stuff, in particular the kind of ethical, societal, economic implications of robots and AI. I'm involved in a number of standards efforts. So, for instance, I was part of the group that wrote BS8611, sounds very boring, but it's the world's first ethical guideline for designers of robots and robotic systems. And right now, in fact, I was on several conference calls today. I'm involved with the IEEE Standards Association. This is the same group that gave us Wi-Fi. And we're currently working on a new set of standards around ethically aligned design. You know, really the big idea is to make sure that the future generation of engineers will bake ethics into AI and robotic systems from the very beginning.
And finally, Anil Seth.
I spend my days researching and thinking about the brain basis of conscious experience. I mean, this is something that we all have. It's the central, most important feature of all our mental lives. What in the brain gives us experiences of the external world, but also of our own selves. And as part of that, you involve thinking about the relationships between real brains and computers and robots as we find them today, the similarities, but also the many, many differences. And we use some machine learning and AI techniques in the lab as a way of interpreting and understanding how real brains work, but without necessarily pretending that these AI systems that we're generating are things like the brain. I think one of the main lessons over the years that I've been working is the brain is not a computer.
All introductions sorted, I wanted a brief definition of AI, which isn't as easy as it sounds. First up, Alan Winfield.
It's hard to pin down, but essentially it's a, if you like, a simulation of natural intelligence. So, I mean, that's the simplest way of thinking about AI.
Well, it is...
or some aspects of natural intelligence. Say,
it is actually a set of techniques that you will use to learn things and solve problems in a similar way that human will do. So the main issue is to solve problems. And some of the problems currently that computers can solve are not really easy for humans to solve because there is a lot of calculations involved. But computers are good in that. But on the other side, some problems that we can easily solve is really, really, really hard for computers because it evolves strategy, it evolves knowledge of general world, and so on and so forth.
I would say that the aim of AI is to make machines that do what machines do in movies. But as soon as we succeed at anything of that, typically we get used to it and say, yeah, that's just automation. That's normal.
I think for me the simplest intuitive definition of AI and of intelligence itself is doing the right thing at the right time.
AI as a field has gone through these cycles of hype and disappointment since probably before the 50s, right? Are we just in another cycle of hype now? And it's hard for me to tell being in the media because that's what we do. Are we just all writing about AI now because we're in a cycle where everybody is saying, A, in academia to us is saying AI is brilliant. Are we heading for another crash of disappointment, do you think?
It's very hard to say. I mean, so many of you will know that in the past there have been what we call AI winters. So this is essentially what that means is that there was a big hype cycle. There was one in the 1970s. There was the so-called fifth generation initiative in Japan. And huge amounts of funding were poured into AI, didn't deliver any results. And then, of course, the funding was cut, hence the winter. I think that's very unlikely now because I think there's so much momentum, particularly with the new, really extraordinary new advances in machine learning, that it's unlikely. And there's another big difference, of course, which is that a lot of funding, now this may be a bad thing, of course, is actually in the private sector.
So being Scandinavian, I'm happy to say I think winter is coming. But that does not necessarily mean that AI is irrelevant or that it's not making a progress. After all, the dot-com bubble burst, but the internet just kept on going better. There is something really new that is happening right now in machine learning and AI, which I think is new and important. But there is also an enormous amount of hype. And there is a risk that in a few months, when the hype cycle perhaps inevitably crashes, we're going to be so embarrassed that we don't want to talk about AI or AI safety or AI ethics. And then we get maybe a lost decade where the technology is getting better, but nobody calls it AI. And then it starts again, and we suddenly wake up. Maybe we should have been thinking about that over the past 10 years.
I want to get back to what you said about the movies as well, being, you know, that's what people often think of as AI, as not just a disembodied neural network doing something clever inside a black box somewhere, but as a robot moving around in the world. And of course, while there have been amazing, really impressive progress in machine learning and in computer programs that sit in black boxes and do useful things with data, we haven't seen that same acceleration of progress in robotics, not nearly so much. So that's, I think, firstly, it says, well, AI is not just one thing. Some people think of it as robotics. Some people think of it as HAL from 2001, not necessarily a robot. And progress is going differently in the different domains.
All that said, there does seem to be a different feel to this latest surge or summer in AI research. One only needs to look at Amazon Echo, Google's DeepMind, and Apple's Siri to see this. And it comes in part from technologies that use neural networks and what's known as deep learning. Anders Sandberg again.
Basically, we are running on 100 billion neurons, more give or take, and each of these neurons are very stupid and simple. They don't know what English is or what apple is, but they're connected together with strength of varying connection. And the original neural network idea was, let's take a lot of simple units, very simplified and inspired by biology, but nothing like real biology, and find ways of training them to produce the right output. So we can give them some data, we see what they produce as output, correct the connections, and then make something that works better and better. So it's very much based on training. And typically you organize this in layers. And back when I was doing my PhD, if you had more than three layers, it was a very deep network. But now we have enormous amount of data, thanks to the web and cameras and stuff like that. And we have enormous computing power. We can actually train them. And suddenly we actually do useful things, which my neural network sadly never did.
Of course, deep learning is not the only machine learning on which we work. Statistical machine learning is really wonderful tool, and we can do a lot of it. And in contrast with deep learning, where deep learning needs a lot of data to learn from, statistical machine learning needs little data to learn from. And that's very important for atypical problems, such as medical problems, for example.
And how much difference has it made having huge amounts of data that you can actually work on?
A great deal. I mean, I think these algorithms that people use now, they have been around, as Anders was saying, for quite a long time. And in fact, intellectually, I think some of the stuff that was done because the data wasn't available to think, well, how can we train things with less data, were really interesting and probably matched closer to what real brains do. But now the availability of vast data training sets, the power of computers to run these networks and train them over these vast training networks has made a big difference. But they clearly don't do things the same way that brains do. So to train one of these networks to, for instance, recognize different breeds of dog given loads of pictures of dog, you've got to train these networks on hundreds of thousands, millions, probably tens of millions of images with many, many, many instances. We humans can learn things very quickly. We can learn on one-shot experiences, transfer our knowledge to other contexts and other situations. Whatever deep networks are doing, they're doing something similar to brains, but we're doing something much more than that. And this, I think, returns to this idea about general AI and narrow AI. And I think maybe we clarify that right at the beginning as well, because
the
successes of AI so far have all been quite domain specific. So you'll think, remember last year there was the success of these networks in beating the world's best Go player. That was incredible. That's a massive achievement. But that's all it could do. It couldn't make you a cup of tea, couldn't even play chess. Yeah. Of course, chess was done before, but the chess player couldn't play Go. Yeah. Self-driving cars can drive themselves, but they can't play Go or make you a cup of tea. Yeah. And so it's very, very specific, and that's what you would call narrow AI. And the achievements that have been made so far are all like that. What people talk about in the community is whether we'll reach the point of general AI. Yeah. And what that's taken to mean is when a system reaches the general performance capabilities of a human being.
Whether or not it's just humans who have this kind of general intelligence is still up for grabs, like much of neuroscience and psychology. But regardless of who has it and how we define it, this generality of intelligence is an important issue in AI.
But the generality of intelligence is an important issue, and of course subject to a lot of debate, because many people say, no, there are different kinds of intelligence, there is not a single intelligence. I happen to disagree with that, but there is certainly truth that we tend to specialize our mindsets, and we probably want machines that are specialized more than general for most purposes. But then there are some who say, yeah, I really want to understand intelligence, I want to build it.
This is back to what you were saying, is that there's this, it's Hans Moravec, I think, who first had this paradox that again, things that we find difficult are things that we can build systems to do quite easily, play chess, whatever, do complex calculations. Making tea is something we find easy, can't get a robot to do that at all yet. So instead of trying to replicate human-level intelligence in all its generality, we're more likely, just as a matter of what's possible, to end up with a symbiotic situation where we have a range of more specialized AI systems that complement and serve as cognitive prosthetics rather than as human replacements.
That's right. Something else I want to sort of nail on this artificial general intelligence before we move on to some of the more nearer term and I think probably more pressing issues around AIs today. And that is something that you look at all the time, the existential risks. I mean, a lot of people will
see stories about prominent people warning about AIs, and they, by that they mean general AIs. And your boss, Nick Bostrom, wrote Superintelligence, 2015, I think it was, raising this issue. Why are we, or some people, so exercised about artificial general intelligence?
Well, it's worth recognizing that the reason we humans are running this planet is not that we're the strongest or fastest animals. It's just that we're slightly smarter than the rest of animals and have a cumulative culture. So we have been acquiring tools and methods. And that means that we, over a very short time span by evolutionary means, have taken over the planet and are now running it for good and ill. And that means that we have a reason to think that if we got another kind of intelligence, things might not necessarily go that well, because we know the trouble we can cause. So earlier you mentioned the general AI that could do everything a human can do. Well, one of the things humans can do is making AI. So you can imagine a general AI being used to make more AI and better AI. It might not necessarily be great at it, but you might have thousands of them running in parallel, and you might get an enormous amount of stuff done. This kind of intelligence explosion is, as far as we know, hypothetical. We don't know whether it can happen. It's a very deep and interesting question. But it seems very clear that if you get to human level intelligence, there is no reason why we should think that it has to stop there, that our brains are the best possible brains of the entire universe. And now, if you got smarter brains that are very good at achieving their goals, well, where does these goals come from? We have evolved goals. But a machine would have programmed goals or something that just ended up as a slip of a learning. So if we were to just program something that was tremendously smart, it would be very powerful, very good at achieving goals. But the goals could be literally a typo or in taking a goal we gave it and taking it to an absurd extreme. That would be a threat to us, and it would be a very difficult threat to deal with, because it would be smart. It would be able to think about what we are going to do and outwit us. Now, this is not a short-term problem. We around the Institute think that this is a very important problem, but it's going to take decades before we really get there. But it might also take us decades to figure out what to do about it. So that's why we're kind of worked up about it and are spending a lot of time in front of the whiteboards, scribbling equations and trying to come up with architectures that keep systems safe and sane.
This intelligence explosion that Anders mentions is what his boss's book Superintelligence warns might lead to our eventual demise. But whether the explosion is years, decades or centuries away, many in the field, including Anders, are deeply concerned about the potential ramifications for what he calls misbehaving systems. Maya Pantic isn't so sure.
It relates to humans, which I don't think computers are humans. Robots do not misbehave, they are misprogrammed. Driverless cars do not misbehave. They actually are not taken the signs that they give are not taken into account by the drivers, so they don't misbehave. This is really bad word.
I disagree here, that if I write a piece of software that's not learning, yes, any misbehaviors or whatever, misactions of the software is in some sense due to my lack of understanding what the program does. But in machine learning, the behavior, and I still think I don't have a better word for it, sorry, is going to be due to the data fed in or its experiences. It's going to be path dependent, and even though I might have written a perfectly sensible learning program, if it gets bad learning experience, it might grow up to be a very misbehaving system.
Anil, did you want to?
Yeah, I mean, just a couple of things. But I think there's the important distinction that you're getting at, Anders, is probably between the more medium or long-term situation, which is this scenario where whatever kinds of systems we have are such that they are bootstrapping themselves beyond our comprehension and control, so that then predicting what they will do to society or to us or to our planet becomes very difficult to do. So I'm glad you're doing it. Of course, technologies of all kinds act as just amplifiers of our actions in the world in which we live in now. And I think that if we're thinking about existential threats and getting that out of the way, now, the real existential threat is that before we even have to worry about any of these Terminator scenarios, the way in which we use and misuse technology just destroys our ability to maintain a habitable planet in the first place. Now, that for me is a very plausible existential problem that we face. And in a way, you know, it's good to worry about the stuff that you worry about, but we should focus collectively more of our attention on some of these more near-term problems and, of course, all the economic disruptions, things we'll probably come on to later.
So maybe it's humans and the way we use AI that we should be focusing on, for now anyway. And after this short break, we'll hear about some of the unknowns we face in attempting to create human-level AI.
If you got the smartest people in the planet to sit down and you said, OK, write us a roadmap from where we are now to artificial general intelligence, they couldn't. Okay. They could have some guesses, you know, some probably quite interesting guesses, but the problem is we simply don't know what the major problems that we will have to solve in order to get there.
And we'll also hear about the importance of bodies when it comes to brains, artificial or not.
There's so much more going on in our brains and our bodies that allow us to do what we do than just running the right program. And all these advances we're seeing in AI aren't really getting into the role that the body plays, the role that our physiology plays.
We'll be right back.
人と自然に会話ができる最新のアンドロイドエリカが3日報道陣に公開されました。
Enjoying this episode of Science Weekly? Then you'll love the latest film from the documentaries team here at The Guardian, Erica Man-Made.
アンドロイドエリカは身長が166センチで年齢は23歳。大阪大学と京都大学のチームが開発しました。
Erica is 23. She has a beautiful, neutral face and speaks with a synthesized voice. She has a degree of autonomy, but can't move her hands yet. Erica is also an android.
Hi. 私の趣味は映画鑑賞、スポーツ観戦、あとはアニメを見ることです。
The brainchild of Hiroshi Ishiguro, Erica and her creators in the film explore what it means to be human, and in doing so, act as a mirror for each and every one of us. To find out more and to watch the movie, head over to theguardian.com/documentaries. Listen out also for next week's episode of Science Weekly, when we'll be hearing some of Erica's answers to questions sent in by Guardian readers. Welcome back to Science Weekly. I'm Ian Sample. Before the break, we heard some excerpts from a live event I hosted, which formed part of our Brainwave series, looking at the future of artificial intelligence. We heard from Professor Alan Winfield about what he believes is the ultimate goal of AI research, to replicate human intelligence. But as explained by Professor Anil Seth, there is a difference between the specialized type of intelligence AI researchers have achieved and the more generalized intelligence found in humans. We also heard from Dr. Anders Sandberg about the dangers of an intelligence explosion and the superintelligent AIs they might create, and importantly, how to stop them from misbehaving, a phrase contested by Professor Maya Pantic, who made the distinction between misbehaved and misprogrammed. One thing our panel did agree on, however, is that artificial general intelligence, or AGI, is still some way off. That said, just how far off is hard to say. Alan Winfield again.
If you got the smartest people in the planet to sit down and you said, OK, write us a roadmap from where we are now to artificial general intelligence, they couldn't. Okay. They could have some guesses, you know, some probably quite interesting guesses, but the problem is we simply don't know what the major problems that we will have to solve in order to get there. And of course, in a sense, that's one of the reasons it's hard to make predictions. Mm. You know, because, I rather think that things happen kind of slowly and it will be, you know, if we eventually get to AGI, which I guess we will, I don't think there's any in principle reason, you know, that we couldn't. Mm. I think it'll be hundreds of years of incremental steps. But, you know, who's to say there isn't some genius kid, you know, programmer in Mumbai right now who's actually coming across those big, you know, roadblocks that we don't know about?
I think there might be a very good principled reason why the smart programmer somewhere, whether it's Mumbai or somewhere else, will just do this. And the reason is it's not just about finding the right program to run on the hardware of our brain. This is the lessons of biology and neuroscience, as we know, that there's so much more going on in our brains and our bodies that allow us to do what we do than just running the right program. And all these advances we're seeing in AI aren't really getting into the role that the body plays, the role that our physiology plays in these issues. Yeah. So it's something that's still a step change away.
I absolutely agree with you, Anil. And you know, what Anil's referring to is embodiment. Mm. And the fact is that natural intelligence is, by definition, embodied. There's no such thing as disembodied natural intelligence. And the role of embodiment is really very poorly understood. I mean, all that we know is that it's very important.
We're really bad at it without the emotional cues that the body gives us. And emotions are, of course, entirely important. An emotion is just the perception of a change in the bodily state. So this old idea back to Descartes that we could have this cold rationality and wouldn't that be fantastic? That doesn't work. You can't reason without emotion. And then, of course, just the ability to act in the world and to perceive the world, that's the difference between play and go and making a cup of tea. Mm. It works very differently from what
they are. Your systems can interpret emotions.
Yes.
Can you give your tools, your programs, can they respond as if they have emotions themselves?
They can understand what other people are showing, not what other people are feeling.
When you say understand,
that means I can actually really decipher what people show. This is very important. So I can understand things like smiles and frowns and gestures and intonation of the voice and different words usage and various stuff, which is all indicative of what emotions people may be in. However, if somebody wants to mask his or her emotions, there is no way I will untangle that in a non-obtrusive way. So if you want actually to have physiological sensors on a human, then yes, you can do that. But otherwise, just from face and voice, you cannot. However, regarding this discussion here, I just want to mention one thing. We still assume, you guys still assume, that intelligence must be something which is first of all human. And the second is that it must be embodied. I don't know why. This is, I think, very much earth related. I don't know why. I mean, computers as such are just digital things. I don't think, you know, maybe different kind of intelligence could be built by embodiment, but I would not limit things by the things as we do them in this earth, really. On another planet, things may be different. And you know, I don't know. I find this actually very limiting.
I'm not sure. I think maybe there's a miss. You can have narrow forms of disembodied intelligence, for sure. Like chess-playing computers are not stupid. They play chess very well. You can do all kinds of complex machine learning without a body. But that's very, very narrow. And there are many different ways to have embodied intelligence as well. I think the point Alan was making, all other creatures are very smart at thriving and surviving within their specific environmental niches, and that's not, you know, that's a version of intelligence. Some are more flexible and less flexible than others. But yeah, certainly I agree, and I think it's a great point to make that the way we are intelligent and is just one point in a vast space of possible ways of being intelligent, and it's a grave mistake. This is back to this anthropocentrism thing, right? It's a grave mistake to use just the way we happen to be as the sole yardstick to measure everything we do by.
As Anil points out, humans are slowly realizing that intelligence comes in many shapes and forms in the animal kingdom. However, many still believe that what creates an apparent human-animal divide also happens to be Anil's favorite C word, consciousness.
Intelligence often gets wrapped up with consciousness. Yeah. And people say, we'll have conscious robots, and that seems to bring in this whole other, and I really don't want to spend too much time on this. I think it can be a diversion away from stuff that's happening here and now or in the next 5 years, but should we be thinking about consciousness in these things, or is that just such a ludicrous far-off idea, or such a long-term unknown that it's really for another day, another time to worry about?
I think it's worth a very small amount of worrying, because we simply don't know what the sufficient mechanisms are for a conscious organism. I know that I am, I'm willing to accept everybody else here is, but we just don't know. And it's not going to be a black and white thing, it's going to be a scale, and it's going to be manifest in different forms in different species, just other biological species. So the way I experience being a self is very embodied. I experience having a body, being a body with particular flexibility and dimension. That's going to be different for an octopus, for instance. Again, because we are both intelligent, compared to other species in the world, or at least we like to think we are, and we are conscious, we tend to lump these things together and think maybe they go together. Couple that with this implicit assumption that the brain is some kind of computer, and you get the idea that a true AI system might also be conscious. But I think these are very separate things. The conscious experience of doing intelligent things is not the only kind of conscious experience there is.
Regardless of whether these AIs and the algorithms they contain will have consciousness, one thing that is sure is that the robots are coming, and automation is likely to have massive effects on the future of humanity. How we live, how we share, and how we work. The latter of these, in fact, is already happening with the likes of algorithms for spam filters, dating sites, image recognition, and reoffending predictions, to name but a few. Should we really be that worried? Anders Sandberg again.
So I think it's worth noticing that these new tasks are perceptual tasks. Basically, you take a lot of data and you know what category or what result is supposed to result, and you figure out a way of taking other data and figuring out what the corresponding result is. And that is why face recognition and computer vision is moving forward so far. This is why we're having so successful autonomous cars. But this is, of course, also why these companies want all our data. And suppose all our web browsing data was private. How would a search engine actually work? We need to at least tell the search engine what web pages we have, and then it's just a dictionary. Obviously, you need a search engine to search the web and actually figure out patterns that we don't know about, that we don't explicitly give it permission to. And this is, of course, the fundamental paradox, because I don't think anybody thinks it's a bad idea if we sift through all the NHS health data and come up with useful way of treating diseases or diagnosing problems. It's just that we're worried that our data might be misunderstood. There is a serious concern about how these algorithms might take biased data and then distill this bias. So now it looks like it's a little neutral black box making a decision, but it accidentally has quite a lot of bias. Or that some aspects of our data kind of get snagged into this and become an indelible part of the system. But overall, the main reason we are working so much on this is that many of these tasks, we don't want to do them ourselves. We want to be reminded of things we need to be reminded about. And we also don't want to have an explicit list of what we want to be reminded of. We want something that's smart enough, has enough common sense, and know us well enough to actually remind us about the stove being on, even though I never explicitly put that onto the list. There is an awful lot of repetitive, boring stuff that we actually should wish to automate as much as possible.
You've talked about bias, that these systems can learn from the training data, because the training data itself contains the inherent biases of the people who collected it. What kinds of things have come out where computers have, or the algorithms have made decisions based on new data which have been biased in some sense?
So the classic example is credit rating systems. So at least in America, they're not allowed to use race as an input. However, neural networks can be trained to find credit ratings, and then they figure out the race of applicants. And given the economic disparities, this means that they might then embody those biases, and now it just looks like a little black box with no intent of having any racial bias. And the programmers making the system didn't intend that either. The problem is, however, the algorithm doesn't care about humans or chairs or gorillas. All of these categories are equally important to the algorithm, so it doesn't care that it's about humans. And similarly, when Microsoft put a chatbot online and it turned into a raving Nazi in 2 days after being exposed to Twitter, that was embarrassing. And again, oops, we should have learned a lesson there, and hopefully we have. But it's very hard to make good predictions, especially because many of these biases can be extremely subtle.
And I think what this really illustrates, these great examples, is a rather shocking fact, which is that we have no standards for, let's call it data curation or anti-bias that can be used, taken by the engineers that build those systems, and even, more importantly, used by certification bodies or regulatory bodies to actually say, yes, this AI system is safe.
So can we have a way of not having an AI released or used that will make decisions about our lives, have it only be released once it has been through an independent bunch of checks where you can say, look, we've tried this and we've tested it with putting in all these different inputs and check the outputs, it looks like it's neutral, because that's not going to be asked.
So
is that possible?
I mean, yes. It is possible, I believe it is possible. And in fact, there is a new standards effort.
It's necessary as well, isn't it?
On how to remove bias from AI systems. I mean, We certainly expect our cars, our washing machines, our electric kettles, and certainly our aeroplanes to be certified as safe. Exactly. Why on earth are we not just expecting but demanding the same for our AI systems?
This, once again, harks back to the fact that it's maybe not the AI we should be worried about, but the humans who are using it and what they're using it for. Another concern is the automation of jobs across the board, which has led many to ask, are we facing another industrial revolution? Maya Pantic again.
Okay, so the assembly jobs.
Assembly jobs?
Yes, those are already taken by robots. Industrial robots, unmovable robots, right? Very simple techniques, put this there, right? However, yes, I believe that fourth industrial revolution is about to come or is coming each day closer. It's because of how the whole world is moving. So there are a couple of things which are very important. So one is digitalization, right? So we are currently working, many of people that I know, which are older than I am, usually talk about having one job and one job for life. However, almost everybody who is the age of my students are talking about having multiple jobs. I will be a consultant here and consultant there, and I'll work for this company for 3 days and so on. So it will be the way we do the jobs. So because we have the internet and we can actually have quite a lot of different jobs and doing these pieces and giving our expertise where is needed. Also, digitalization brought different ways we communicate with each other. So currently, we are using a lot of these social networks. In fact, currently, the percentage in UK is 25% of relationships are started with online dating. Current online dating is actually, a lot of online dating is considered exceptionally good and easy way, and also the only way, because we, one way or the other, people don't talk that much, I guess, as they talked before, I don't know. But this is the fact.
We just post.
We just post, yes. Yeah. Further, if you think about things like librarians, telephone operators, cashiers are even nowadays, we have less and less cashiers. Everything is automated, right?
But there's more cashiers.
But there is more cashiers still. But in principle, previously, it was more. Somebody told me, Amazon is really horrific because they use in magazines only robots. I don't see why is that horrific. This is just easier and probably even human safer and human friendlier, because working in magazines, I don't think that's really a fun job.
But are we not going to see, or are we going to see whole jobs go, or is this going to be aspects of our jobs that are easy, that work with this sort of stuff that will be automated and that'll be handy, that'll be my intelligent assistant kind of thing? Or will some people really have their
jobs just gone? So this, what I told you, I believe these jobs will be gone.
Right.
But I also believe a lot of jobs will be a symbiosis between machines and humans. Mm. And doctors are definitely, they already actually do that. Mm. We have all these different kind of scans, and then the machines actually programs combine and mosaic these scans. So for us to see what's going on, we can build, for example, IBM Watson has this system in which you build in all the documents of particular disease, and the doctor who is specialist for this disease, for example, oncology, is getting a summary of the of those documents, which is wonderful because it's much easier and you have it. The knowledge can be updated online. This is that's really really wonderful.
There's something I find just on the jobs issue. Something that strikes me as always a little bit politically uncomfortable about this. That yes, of course, there's going to be disruptive change. Some jobs may go entirely, may go partially. But people who worry about these things seem to get excessively worried when it's their own kinds of jobs that are under threat. So, yes, there might be assembly line jobs that are going, long-distance lorry drivers might be replaced by autonomous vehicles. But it's when white-collar jobs seem to be under threat that people suddenly start to get really worked up about it. And these things could be equally disruptive in terms of their effects on society and on individuals. And yeah, I think we should, that's another bias that I think we need to bear in mind.
I completely agree. It's pretty clear that when a job is threatened, even by change, it doesn't even be threatened to going out of existence, just by change, and it's a job that has a great deal of political or social voice, then of course there is going to be a lot of grumbling heard. Right now it looks like any routine job that you can give a crisp problem definition of, that is somewhat threatened. It might take a long while before you get there, but this is, of course, why I got the best, safest job ever, philosopher. Nobody has a clue what it is, not even philosophers. But in general, this is true for many jobs. Many jobs have some weird core where it's slightly ill-defined what's going on. But then you have the routine parts, and they can probably be automated. Whether we want to automate them or not depends a lot on how we also want to style the job. So when thinking about automating parts of medicine, given that it's so important to have healthcare work well and be cheap, we say, yeah. Automating military forces, oh, that's kind of creepier. Automated crime, yeah, that's a job we definitely don't want to have any more automation in. Unfortunately, nobody's going to ask us whether the criminals are going to get to set up better botnets or spam filters or ransomware or whatever else those clever people can come up with.
We haven't talked about inequality yet and whether AIs might drive inequality in some sense. This can happen in obviously a zillion different ways, but you know, certainly impact on jobs, but also where does the money go that is earned from these things? Presumably productivity will go up. Does that money all go into the top five or six tech companies, and is that a problem?
I think it is. It's a fallacy that the Luddites were anti-technology, you know, way back in the first Industrial Revolution. They were not anti-technology, they were anti-starvation. And that makes me a Luddite. I'm also anti-poverty. And I, if anything, Ian, I worry more, I worry about technological unemployment, but I worry more about increased economic inequality as a result of technology. So, you know, because of that worry, I've become an advocate for wealth distribution, things like the universal basic income or negative income tax. There are different ways of doing it. But I think it's absolutely essential that all in society should share the wealth, if you like, the bounty, you know, call it a kind of, technology premium. Because after all, we've all invested in this technology. You know, why should only the 0.1%, you know, the handful of companies that own the technology take all the wealth? I think that's wrong. This is really a political question, it's not a technical
question. But they would argue, presumably, we made it, we have the skillful people, it's our technology.
They wouldn't have made any of it unless it had been for the massive public investments that went into all the research and development.
I mean, all these PhD students which they took and all these postdocs which they took were educated by us.
Yeah, by public money.
By public money. So it is absolutely not true that the innovation is purely theirs and can be or remain in private domain.
But this the, is IP, which, dear, the IP,
This is absolutely outrageous, actually. But that we currently have Google and Amazon and Facebook, like five companies that are taking absolutely everybody from the academia.
I think this is PhD, postdocs?
It's not only us, it's also professors. But the main things are PhDs and postdocs. Because we do not have the next generation. You're talking about, I don't know who said that, who will actually educate those people that need re-education? Who will educate our kids? I think this is absolutely outrageous. And this, what Alan is saying, is that they will also have, because they bought all of these guys, really smart guys, they will actually own the innovation. Yeah. I think this is outrageous, really, really wrong.
And when you say guys, it is 97% men. If you look at the top CEOs
yes,
in these companies,
yes.
it's so it's not even just
that's a separate issue we can talk about.
Yeah. Andrew, did you want to add anything on this?
I was thinking that it's wrong to have been publicly educated and then going into it, that would also make the little app designer in his bedroom, in some sense, we need to redistribute the wealth from his app. There is a lot of interesting stuff going on about open sourcing this technology. There is a very open question, actually, whether it matters if I distribute my AI software if I don't distribute the data necessary to train it. So some critics are arguing that actually maybe this doesn't matter so much, or maybe we should go for open data repositories. So there is more than wealth one can redistribute, and one can create all sorts of interesting patterns here.
So, whether you're scared of the rise of the robots or you welcome it, one thing that's for sure is that AI is here, and it's here to stay. Special thanks this week to all my guests, Professor Anil Seth, Professor Maya Pantic, Dr. Anders Sandberg, and Professor Alan Winfield. Thanks also to the Guardian Members Events team for hosting the night. To find out more, head over to membership.theguardian.com/events. I'm Ian Sample. This is Science Weekly.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.